Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Scarface, making it easy for rappers to pick their favorite movie since 1983. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me is James.
Thanks for welcoming me.
Yeah, well, I think it's a weekly tradition. Let's just get right to it, shall we?
It's just getting shorter and shorter. Yep. Okay. Well, let's start this one with another childhood anecdote.
Oh, a twist.
Not really.
It was sarcasm.
I grew up with cats, as you know.
Yeah. I hate cats, yeah. For those listening.
And I don't mean I grew up, like, raised by feral cats in an alley. I mean, we had domestic house cats as pets as a child. And since I was pretty young, so I kind of grew up around them, and they used to freak me out a bit, and I used to think that they, like, were watching me and, like, knew what was going on.
Okay.
And if I was doing things I wasn't supposed to do, I thought they were, like, somehow gonna not tell my parents, but as though my cats had, like, cameras in their eyes.
Okay.
And somehow this was gonna get transmitted back to my parents at some point. And then I grew up a little bit and thought that was kind of a stupid thing.
Yes. I mean, I didn't want to say it.
But then, in March 31st, 1999, a movie came out that proved that I wasn't wrong and that I wasn't crazy or stupid as a child.
Okay.
And that movie was The Matrix.
Yes. Okay. Can you explain that?
Well, it just proved to me, or at least made it possible in my mind, that maybe everything is being watched and everything is being controlled.
And it's the cats. The cats are Agent Smith?
Yes. That's it. Well, my cat was named Hugo Weaving when I was young.
Okay.
Anyway, we're here to talk about The Matrix.
Yeah.
The first one.
Yes.
The only one.
Not the only one, but...
Well, the
only one we have time for today.
Yeah. And I think the most interesting one. I actually really do like the second one a lot, but...
Yeah, we're both on the same page there.
Yeah, there's...
And the third one's an abortion.
Yes. That is true. Yeah. There's just a lot going on in the first one. A lot to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So good thing you cut my
banter short. Yeah, and I'm going to continue. Let's move on. The Matrix.
Yep.
Where do we start?
Start at the beginning, I think.
Okay. Well.
Great place to begin. I kind of always forget that this movie starts with Trinity being arrested.
Or, yeah, hell yeah.
Trying to be arrested.
Yeah, it starts with one of the three or four most iconic shots in the movie.
I know.
Of which there are so many iconic shots.
There are tons, but yeah, the most spoofed thing about this movie, and one of the most spoofed things for, like, the end of 99 and the start of 2000s, is the bullet time kick that Trinity delivers to one unsuspecting cop.
Yeah, it's that in the bullet time, bullet dodge.
Back one.
Yeah.
No Fat Joe.
Are we sure that song wasn't based on it?
So yeah, Trinity's there in upper floor of a building. The police are trying to arrest her. Agents show up just as they're about to enter the room.
Agents are like the Matrix's version of FBI.
Oh yeah.
For those who haven't seen The Matrix and are some reason listening to this podcast.
Yeah. And then they go ahead with it, try to arrest her. The agents know better, but the cops don't. And Trinity just opens up a big can of whoop-ass.
Yeah, she destroys some people.
She runs off some walls. She kicks some face.
Yep.
The camera spins around her.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of a chase on the rooftops.
Rooftops of Dark City.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. one of the many things that The Matrix took from other movies.
Yes.
But yeah, it's kind of a wicked chase scene. The agent jumps to show us that these agents are fairly superior.
Yeah, and you don't really know the whole idea of The Matrix being this digital world that can have rules be bent and broken and things like that. So the viewer is kind of in the same place as these cops are at this point, where this seems pretty amazing and insane.
Yes.
One of my least favorite parts of the movie is here, though.
Which is?
When Trinity does her jump off the building.
And just sort of fly.
And dives through the window and spinning. I just, this movie holds up amazingly well graphically. And I think that's, like, the one part I don't like.
Okay. That's fine.
That's all. Otherwise.
I like the part where she's lying at the bottom of the stairs, though. And she's like, get up, Trinity.
Yeah.
Get up. I actually think of that anytime, like, I'm in bed and it's like, I have to get up and go to work. It's like, get up, Alex. Get up. That's what I think about every
Slightly
time.
Slightly less threatening than an agent jumping at you.
Exactly. But that's what I think about
every
time. The premise
is there. I understand. And she gets away. And we get established that the way to get out of this world is to pick up a landline.
Yes.
Which would make the world of 2011 a difficult place to escape from when chased by agents.
Now, landlines are still there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not as many.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the truck crashes into the phone booth that she's in, and then you find out that she's got away. And then we get our first kind of title card, but not quite.
Well, there isn't a title card in this movie, is there?
Not a title card. It's you get the first characters, though. You get those green characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Out. And the show's the words of The Matrix.
Oh, does it? Okay. Yeah. I couldn't remember.
I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it does. And then we kind of zoom out from those digital characters, and it ends up being words on Keanu Reeves / Thomas Anderson / Neo's computer screen.
Yes.
It's established that he's Neo and that he's some kind of insanely talented hacker.
And that he is searching.
Yes. That he is searching.
But for what?
And knock, knock, Neo.
Yeah.
Then skinny Louis C.K. shows up at his door with his girlfriend du jour.
That's right.
And buys a disc off Neo.
Yes. Buys, you know, the idea is that Neo, Thomas Anderson, is selling these programs illegally, you know, and it's extremely illegal because he makes sure that Louis C.K. knows not to let anybody know if he gets caught using it, where he got it from, you know?
Yeah, and right away, I mean, within 30 seconds, maybe a minute, we get hit with a bunch of different allusions really quickly.
Yes.
And a bunch of kind of references to other things, and we
in general, this movie does not waste time.
No, exactly. Yeah. It gets right to it, and it is absolutely packed with allusions, as I said. We get the White Rabbit from Alice in Wonderland. We get Simulation and Simulacra, a book, and some references to Neo's Messiah status.
Yes.
All really quickly. So, yeah, as you said, this movie does not waste a lot of time. The script is just, like, jam-packed with these visual references and these some of the dialogue is things that when you've watched it over and over again, you start to understand how kind of dense this movie is.
Yeah.
With things.
Yeah. I feel like had I not seen this for the first time when I was 13, I would have kind of picked up on
some of them. Yeah, yeah. But some of them you want to, it's one of those ones where the rewatch value is high because some things you learn later.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that I necessarily, if I was 20 in 1999, I don't know that I would agree.
Well, I just mean in that first one, we give him the disc and he says, "You're my own personal Jesus Christ."
Yep.
I don't know. I just think things like that, when you know the whole movie, things like are a bit more valuable.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the movie is generally very upfront about its references.
Okay.
I mean, seeing the Baudrillard book is pretty easy.
Yeah.
And also, when anytime someone says White Rabbit, you think Alice in Wonderland, and they talk about a rabbit hole soon after, and they say Alice in Wonderland at one point in the movie. So,
fun fact about Simulation Simulacra, required reading for the entire cast and crew of The Matrix.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. At all.
Which is a very dense, abstract book for people who haven't tried to read it before.
It's a fun read.
Yeah.
I like it.
It's just a little off the wall and probably a bit of a stretch for people like working camera, I mean, lights and stuff. I meant to say lights.
Still, people work lights or not. Those are my people.
I didn't say they're stupid. I just mean it's far, like, I just think it's a bit of a stretch for them how is this going to affect the lighting?
No, it's fine. I'm just being an asshole.
Okay. Like usual.
Yeah.
So,
Luke, I like to pretend that I'm in a union and have to defend my union brothers and sisters. Continue.
So, skinny Louis C.K.
Yes.
And du jour.
Yes.
Put their brains together and decide that Thomas Anderson should come out to the club with them.
Yep. And he seems reluctant, but then he sees a white rabbit on du jour's shoulder.
A tattoo of a white rabbit.
Pardon?
A tattoo of a white rabbit.
Yeah. Sorry. What did I say?
Just a white rabbit.
Oh, okay,
I just didn't want like a...
Oh, yeah.
Parrot thing. Like she walks around with a bunny on her shoulder.
Although skinny Louis C.K. kind of looks like a pirate, and he's got WWE wrestler Edge in the background.
Yeah, and that whole gang look. If anybody, like, in movies is going to have a bunny that they just carry around with them, it's that group gang right there.
when Neo was on, or when Mr. Anderson was on his computer, he got a message saying follow the White Rabbit right before these people showed up at his door. So he follows the White Rabbit and they go to a club where Trinity introduces herself to Neo while Neo is having just a ball leaning against the wall, doing nothing.
It's hard not to have fun when you listen to Dragula.
Well, that's true.
It's
true.
It's Rob Zombie. It's everyone's jam.
Yeah.
He meets Trinity, says, you know, he's heard of her, thought it was a guy, but she's apparently this world-famous hacker, got into the IRS D-base. cool way to say database.
Oh, you gotta, like I said, this movie's very economical. They save time wherever
time
they go.
Time for three letters. So, you know, they party. I guess he stays up late, wakes up late. It's a little bit late for work.
Yeah.
Goes to his job at Metacortex.
Yes.
And he works as a computer programmer there. Mm-hmm. For being late, I guess this isn't his first time. His boss sits him down and you get a bit of a history of Mr. Anderson. He, I guess, isn't the best employee. He seems to be very talented, but feels he's above the rules.
Yes.
And, you know, it's very well established that this guy knows computers very well, but his mind is somewhere else. He doesn't seem to be content with the life that he's living. Then he gets a phone call on a phone that he had delivered to him
by FedEx. And the FedEx guy suspiciously says, "Have a nice day."
Yeah, what is that about?
Which Thomas Anderson is not used to hearing, apparently, because he reacts very strangely.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And the phone rings right away. It's a mysterious voice who Neo knows is Morpheus. Because of the mysterious nature of what's going on now.
Okay.
And he starts getting directions to get away from agents who have just appeared at kind of the door to his floor.
Yes.
He follows everything that Morpheus says. He gives him advice to, you know, run down the hall, how to get away from them. Eventually he gets, Morpheus asks
Neo.
Yes. To do something very risky, which was to, like, climb outside on a thin ledge and get on the scaffolding to get on the roof to get out of the building. It's too scary for Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. Are you kidding me? He opened the window. I wouldn't get that far.
Yeah, I wouldn't
know
that either.
I would generally be freaked out being on that floor, let alone being near a window on that floor.
And so he goes out of the building under the custody of the agents.
Yes. And Trinity, on her motorcycle, sees this. Shit.
And they say shit so much in this movie, I learned.
Yeah. No, it's
never
realized
a lot. And then...
it punctuates a lot of scenes, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we kind of get a bit more of an indication of that the agents aren't just normal people, are they?
No, they're not.
That turned into my Agent Smith impression.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I know. I can tell. Yeah, they sort of go to interrogate Mr. Anderson and call him, and Agent Smith calls him Mr. Anderson repeatedly and speaks like Hugo Weaving. And it's shown to Anderson that these agents kind of have some sort of supernatural power when Agent Smith says, "What good is a phone call if you can't even speak?" And then suddenly Thomas Anderson no longer has a mouth.
Yes.
And they sort of put a bug type thing in his belly button, and then he sort of wakes up and he's like, "Oh, I had a nightmare." But then pretty quickly he gets sort of, how does Trinity and then pick him up?
I forget.
Okay.
I'm waiting.
And then
yeah, he's undeterred by this nightmare, really chalks it up to a nightmare. He's pretty sure that the whole Trinity thing was real though, so agrees to meet up with her again, and then they pick him up in a car and suck that bug out of his belly button again.
Yep.
And Mr. Anderson realizes that that was real. He thought it was a nightmare, but it is real.
Mm-hmm.
With that kind of tracking device out of him, they're free to go and meet Morpheus.
Yes.
And the agents, Agent Smith, have made it clear that they're just using Thomas Anderson to get to Morpheus. They don't really care about Thomas Anderson. They just know that he has been contacted by Morpheus. And so pretty much all these measures are just to make sure that Morpheus is safe and the agents don't get to him.
Yep.
But Thomas Anderson goes and meets him, gets some more speeches about
Rabbit holes. Alice's in Wonderland.
Yes. And sleeping when you're dreaming and dreaming when you're awake or something. And then he's given the option to take a blue pill or a red pill. What's he do?
Takes the red pill.
What do you do?
I think at that point you got to take the red pill.
Yeah? All right. So he takes the red pill and...
Look, I'm not a computer programmer. I'll never be faced with this choice.
Yeah, it's true. Typical danger of that trade.
Exactly.
Pharmaceuticals.
Pills.
Yeah. And so he takes the red pill, gets all freaky deaky for a couple seconds, not in a sexual way.
Yeah.
Wakes up in this liquid filled pod with no hair and no eyebrows and sockets coming out of his arms and his back and his neck, and gets flushed down a tube. And
he's basically being born.
Yeah.
This is what's happening here.
In a freaky cyberpunk metal technology way.
Yeah.
And he finds himself on this kind of spaceship.
Yes.
Ship called the Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
Trinity and Morpheus are there, who he knows. Also, Apoc is there, who he knows as well. Mm-hmm. Or is it Switch? I don't know. Apoc or Switch?
Switch is the girl. Apoc is the dude.
Yes, okay. And he meets Tank and Dozer and Mouse and the rest of the gang of Misfit Rebels.
Yeah. Did you say Cypher already?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Joey Pants.
Yeah. We all love Joey Pants.
Okay. And so Morpheus is the leader, played by Lawrence Fishburne, mm-hmm. who finally starts explaining in real terms what the Matrix is and where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually the year 2199 instead of 1999.
That's their best estimate.
Yeah, they don't know for sure.
Yeah.
So it's sometime around there, and Morpheus explains that basically Mr. Anderson's life up until this point has been him living inside a computer simulation inside of his own brain.
Yeah.
Because the machines took over the world and are using the humans for fuel.
Yeah, basically. And that's what all those pods of bodies are. Yes.
So it's almost 2199, but they think it's 1999, which Morpheus calls the peak of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know.
He really liked bubblegum pop.
And Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And
yes.
New episodes of Dharma and Greg.
Yeah.
And it comes clear that, you know, they're in this this rebellion against the machines who now kind of rule the world. But Morpheus thinks that Neo is the one. And the one is going to be the person who wins the world back for humanity and mm-hmm. destroys the machines again. We run into one of the other most famous lines from this movie when Morpheus teaches Neo some other things. Well, I guess Tank teaches him, but they plug him back into some other form of the Matrix that they've designed themselves and teach him
basically any sort of martial arts he could possibly. Yes. Like they teach him drunken boxing, yep. like, you know, everything. And Kung Fu,
yes.
which Neo proclaims that he knows, and Morpheus says, show me.
Yeah.
And then we get an awesome fight scene.
Yeah. They fight in a mind dojo for a little bit.
Dojo of the mind.
And yeah, so they fight it up, then they go and meet the Oracle, because that's the next step in being the one.
Yeah, no, there's like... this movie, not a lot happens, but so much happens. Like, I don't know, It's very quick moving. It's sort of like task, 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 task. And half of those tasks are fights.
And for a movie that people say is so philosophical and intellectual, like it clips along at a very good pace.
Oh, yeah.
Without a long, boring speech every 5 minutes.
It's just that they can put in, enough lines and throw Baudrillard at you that it's just sort of like you can infer, basically.
Yeah.
And there are key themes in it that sort of get focused on and... they come back to them every once in a while, but there's never any real focus on them. You know, this is still a fairly mass movie. You know?
Yeah, no, and they just, it's a lot of prompts. Like, you can really take it as deep as you want. There's just a lot of ideas there to play with, but it is an action movie. Like, it moves and it moves. So it does slow down for a little bit when they go to meet the Oracle. Morpheus brings Mr. Anderson, who
we can call him
pretty
Neo.
Much Neo now.
Let's just call him Neo.
Okay. Yeah. But I like saying Mr. Anderson.
I know you do.
So he brings Neo to the Oracle, and the Oracle is there to determine whether or not Neo is the one.
Mm-hmm.
How's the scene go? Is this your favorite scene in the movie?
Probably.
Really?
Yeah. Outside of like an action movie or action scene.
Oh, well, that changes things.
Okay. Well, even including action scenes, it's close. Which right. I think says a lot, given that the action in this movie is incredible.
Yeah,
awesome. So I think that says a lot about how much I like the scene.
Yep.
I generally like the Oracle. I like the idea of the Oracle. I love the
Maya Rudolph-ness of it all.
Yeah. Yeah, the old Maya Rudolph-ness of it all. I love the line about the vase, like, don't worry about the vase. And then he's like, oh, he knocks it over. He's like, oh, crap, I'm sorry. She says, what's really going to bake your noodle later on? Is would you have even done it if I never said anything?
Yeah.
I love that.
I love noodle baking.
Yeah, specifically the phrase, bake your noodle.
On the IMDb page for The Matrix, there's a frequently asked question that says, what does bake your noodle mean? I'm not making that up at all.
So what does it mean?
It's so easy to piece that.
No, I know. It's not hard at all. It's like I didn't know what balls to bone was. That balls to bone was a saying before the Oracle said it, but it's not hard to piece together.
And so what does what's the Oracle tell Neo?
That he, well, she gets a lot done too. She says that, basically says, Trinity's in love with you. One point, or you are not the one, as Morpheus is saying. And at one,
Or you're waiting for something.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. And that Morpheus, there's going to come a time where you have to choose between your life or Morpheus's.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 5 minute scene, three very big things are established.
And then he eats a cookie.
Yeah. By the time he finishes the cookie, he'll feel right as rain.
Yep. So. And it seems like he does.
Yeah. Well, as right as rain as Neo ever feels.
Yeah. And then after this is where they have to try to get back into the real world.
Cause yes.
The Oracle lives in the Matrix still.
Yeah.
So they have to go in with their awesome leather clothing into the Matrix.
Yeah.
And then, again, they need the phone line to get out. And while they're trying to get back to the real world, Neo experiences a bit of deja vu.
Yes. Yeah, he sees a black cat and then sees it again immediately after.
The same cat.
Which has never been my perception of deja vu, by the way. I don't like. I always feel
you
like...
You don't see it twice, you feel it like you experienced it a long time ago.
Yeah, like the one thing of deja vu I always remember is sort of like when I was a kid, I felt like I was in a room watching this specific show before, you know? And like there was I was with a person that I was never ever watching TV with before or after.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that. It's like, oh, I've re-entered something that I've already been in, you know? It's not
like reality skips.
Yeah, exactly.
Like which is,
yeah, it's CD. Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of how the Matrix portrays it. But.
Yeah, but it's a sign that something has changed in the Matrix, which makes sense digitally a little bit.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the group freaks out because they know what this mean, and agents and some cops start attacking them.
Yes.
Because they're after Morpheus. Mouse gets killed, sadly.
Yeah.
With his cool hairdo and all guns.
His cool hairdo? I don't remember hairdo.
So bad.
Yeah.
In that part. By the way, that should be Jamie Kennedy. Anyway.
Well, yeah, and it was 1999. It probably should have been Jamie Kennedy.
I know. It makes so much sense. It's so bad. It's so sad that he was probably too big to be in the Matrix at that point, or in that role in the Matrix at that point. And so, sure enough, there is a fight. They try to sneak away. Cypher blows it.
So Cypher.
I know. It's the most Cypherist thing I've ever heard. The fairiousness. one of the SWAT team guys hears that they're in the wall, reaches through, grabs a hold of Neo, and, you know, it's going to be trouble if they get Neo because he's supposed to be the one.
Exactly. And who believes in Neo more than
Neo
Morpheus
or anybody?
Yeah, yeah. So Morpheus puts his hands out and goes, ah, and then like goes through the wall, which is awesome.
Yep.
And basically starts fighting this guy who is an agent and, you know, another.
Turned cool. into an agent. Yeah.
He turned into an agent once Neo started shooting at him, I think.
Oh, okay.
And then he comes back, he puts his hand through the wall, and he's an agent by that point.
Okay.
And then Morpheus is fighting him, and, you know, and then this giant group of cops eventually sort of beat the crap out of Morpheus.
Yeah.
They've taken him.
Yes. And just as the Oracle predicted, Morpheus tried to sacrifice himself to save Neo.
Exactly.
How
oracle-y of her.
Exactly. At this point, we find out Cypher is a dick.
Yes.
Not just because he sneezes at inopportune times.
And has douchey facial hair, but...
But he has betrayed the group.
Mm-hmm.
The rebels.
And he starts... He is back in the Nebuchadnezzar. He's the first one to get to a landline. And he...
Yeah, it's Tank gets him back. So it's just Tank, who is the operator, who is the one in charge of getting them between the Matrix and the real world.
His brother Dozer is also on the ship.
Yeah.
And then...
So they bring Cypher back. Cypher grabs this insane weapon gun of some kind.
Yeah. And...
shoots the two of them.
Yep. Basically, and then he starts knocking off the rest of the group.
Yeah, he grabs the headset.
In, yeah, typically evil monologue-y fashion.
explains everything that he's done and will do. Talks to Trinity about his feeling towards her and his dastardly plans.
Yep.
Again, pulling the plug on everybody. And when you die in the real world, you die in the Matrix as well.
And
so
pulling the plug will just kill you.
Yeah.
Basically.
So people just kind of start dropping dead. And, it's the end of...
Memorably Switch. In Switch's case. Her line, not like this, not like this, is very important to an understanding of the Matrix, I find.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, as far as understanding the memes of the Matrix.
And just when Cypher's about to kill Neo right in front of Trinity's sad, sad eyes.
Yeah.
Tank comes back to life, kills Cypher.
Yes.
And then, so we're left with Neo.
He doesn't come back to life. And,
well, it's not revealed that he was alive.
That he wasn't so dead, as dead as Cyberpunk.
Yeah, because no one would come back to life in this movie, right?
No, God, no. Never.
Except the... no, we'll save it. Spoilers! So, now everybody's dead except Neo, Tank, Trinity, and Morpheus, who is in captivity.
Yes.
So, Tank brings Neo and Trinity back to the real world, so they're chilling in the Nebuchadnezzar. And chilling is the word.
Yeah.
This is my other question.
Yeah.
By other, I mean first.
Yes.
Why do they always hang? Like, okay, they have to physically be in the Nebuchadnezzar, right?
Yep.
But why don't they spend more time in like the made up worlds, like the training worlds and things like that? Because like the Nebuchadnezzar is dirty and gray and small and cold and terrible.
I think it's sort of to stay on alert, basically.
I guess like
the whole
I
thing,
think
they're
one
constant.
Two of them should guard, and then the other ones go to like. Well, skee-ball tournaments.
Do skee-ball tournaments happen anywhere?
Yes. David Spade was once a skee-ball tournament champion.
Oh, my God.
Look it up.
I'm not going to do that, but I'll trust you. I may repeat that fact to big David Spade fans that I meet.
They'll already know. They're bigger the fans than you.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think the idea is they must remain constantly vigilant. What if those, what are they called? Like
sentinels.
The sentinels come and attack the Nebuchadnezzar. You know, you want to have all hands on deck, and you can't be in the Matrix when the sentinels come. So it's sort of like you can't use the EMP.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, you know, don't go into the Matrix unless you have to. Basically.
Yeah, it's a good point that they have a shitty life where they live
on
a boat.
Terrible life.
Yeah, are constantly being hunted down.
They're just in war. They're in a type of war.
Yeah. A very long, long war where they don't know when it is and don't know other living human beings very well.
Yeah, forget the seven-year war. This is the seven-millennium war.
And so they're back in the Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes.
Except for Morpheus, who is now at Agent Headquarters.
Yes.
/
Giant building.
Columbia Pictures in Sydney, Australia.
Is it?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Okay.
Columbia? Paramount? Something. Anyway. And they're trying to crack into Morpheus' head because he has the codes for Zion, which is the last city of the humans.
Mm-hmm. And if the war ended tomorrow, Zion is where the party would be.
Right. And so they are using serums and machines to try to break into his head and get the codes.
It's pronounced machines.
Not yet. It's not.
I know. I wish Red was still producing this podcast because Red does an amazing Morpheus impression.
Absolutely. And so basically if they're going to get these codes and able to ruin Zion and the Nebuchadnezzar, that's basically the end of the war. And the machines are going to win forever.
Yep.
And that's bad for those keeping track at
home. So Tank and Trinity and Neo are basically going to pull the plug on Morpheus. They're going to kill him.
Yeah.
Which the agents don't seem to be particularly worried about happening. You know, it seems like they would probably be aware of that they could kill Morpheus at any time, right?
That's true. But they're doing it. Like, what are they? How's that going to change their plan? They're trying to crack in as quickly as they can.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know. I just don't see a lot of sense of urgency with them.
Okay, that's true.
But they're not quick-moving people. The idea is they're very steady. They're a computer program. But, yeah, and then Neo's like, no.
Yeah.
We're not doing this. I'm going to go try and save him.
Yeah, and for the first time, Neo starts to believe he's the one, it seems like, right?
I don't know that he started... I don't think that necessarily. I think he just sort of... It's like, no, I'm not going to stand by and just let this happen. There's another way to do this. Let's try this.
And what is that other way?
him and Trinity end up going in the Matrix together. Neo doesn't want her to go, but she's the commanding officer on the ship without Morpheus there. So she says, screw you. I'm going. Yep. And then they get guns. Lots of guns. And Trinity says to Neo, nobody's ever tried something like this before. Neo says, that's why it's going to work. And then they go, and there is a very memorable lobby gunfight, is awesome.
Yeah.
And I watched 1,000 times when I was younger.
Yep. It gets a rite of passage for males our age.
Yeah, there was a lot of rewinding on this scene.
Yeah. But. So they go to the lobby of this building, just kind of armed to the teeth. Almost literally.
Yeah, exactly.
And fight some more of those SWAT dudes.
I believe that's the technical term.
Lots of guns are fired.
Yep.
Lots of
people die.
Lots of trench coats billow.
Yes. one specifically.
But how it billows.
Yeah.
And lots of empty shell casings bounce off the floor very nearby a billowing trench coat.
And the action's just awesome.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, nothing's accomplished other than a lot of death. And, you know, we've beat this level. Let's move up a level.
It's some funky music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Real question for you. Mm-hmm. Is this one of the best action scenes ever?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah. You confident in saying that?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that fine? Is that
okay? No, that's more
I think,
than fine.
I think there are multiple action sequences in this movie that are up for...
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah.
What's as good as that?
The Neo Morpheus fight. That's awesome.
Yeah, I like the lobby scene more, mm-hmm. but it's cool.
And the Neo agent fight towards the end gets pretty wicked. Yeah,
it's cool.
Like, even just the part where they're flying at each other shooting guns, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's cool. Mm-hmm. All right, so yeah, we're going to put a check mark next to that one. Cool. Then they get up to Morpheus eventually.
Yes.
Take the elevator.
Yeah, yeah.
Comically after yeah. all that.
Yep. Well, they drop a bomb like badasses.
Yeah, that's true.
Sort of make sure nobody else can do the same.
Yep.
And yeah, how do they... Yeah, they get up to the roof.
They get up to the roof.
And kill some more people. We get the possibly most iconic moment in The Matrix where Neo... realizes he can dodge bullets when an agent's shooting at him.
Yes.
And, you know, dodge, you know, they get the bullet time. For those listening at home, I sort of dodged my shoulders to imitate Neo.
But he did it in bullet time. Yeah. So it was a lot more impressive than he just made it sound.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really awesome. Yep. And then Trinity somehow has snuck up on this agent and kills him. And... then they fight some more people. Trinity learns how to fly a helicopter.
Yep.
And
through science.
programming.
Yeah. That's
and,
science.
Okay, fair enough. Computer science. And yeah, they basically go to rescue Morpheus. Neo mans the gun. Trinity womans the helicopter. And they just shoot the shit out of this room.
Don't they?
Yeah. Neo does not see...
pretty recklessly.
Oh, there's a shot where the gun is actually, like, doing a circle. He's just moving the gun in a circle. It's just shooting anywhere.
But if he can dodge bullets, you have to think he can aim bullets just as well, right?
That's true.
So.
Yeah.
So the agents are terrified.
Yeah. They're sort of ducking out, and then they... Neo sort of, you know, they have an eye conversation with Morpheus, and Morpheus breaks out of his handcuffs and starts running. In another cool scene or cool bit that I really like, the bullet time around Morpheus's run, he gets shot in the leg. The part I don't like is that the bullets keep moving and Morpheus is totally still. I don't care for that at all.
Okay.
But and Morpheus gets shot in the leg. Neo's like, he's not going to make it. And then he sort of jumps to meet him halfway, and then they're just flying around. That, you know, he catches Morpheus, and then Trinity flies away, and they're flying around flying around the city, which was a thing that people did all the time in the 90s and in action movies. And now you just can't do it anymore.
Yeah, the helicopter hanging. And city flying.
Yeah. It happened fairly often. I think Swordfish was the last thing I remember that happening.
It got replaced by killing helicopters with cars.
That's happened one time. As far as I can remember.
Staple of the genre.
Yeah. And then sort of there's, the helicopter gets shot or something like that. And Neo is still, tethered to it, I guess. He has sort of landed safely with Morpheus, but Trinity is going to die, basically. Like, this helicopter's falling.
Yep.
And Trinity grabs the rope and shoots it off, and the helicopter crashes in the building, which is awesome.
Super cool.
And then, you know, Neo basically pulls her up and saves her. And this is sort of where we get the realization that Neo sort of realizes it. The audience realizes it. Trinity realizes it. He's the one, you know, or he's supposed to be the one.
Yes.
And we get a very triumphant music cue.
Yep. Yes, we do. Yeah.
A music cue that I love. And, then they have to basically get back to the Nebuchadnezzar.
They find a phone.
Yeah.
Morpheus and Trinity get away. But just before Neo's about to get back to the Nebuchadnezzar...
a homeless dude turns into an agent.
Yep.
Yeah.
The badass agent.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're all badass, let's be honest.
But Agent Smith is a special kind.
Yes, absolutely.
And, yeah, and then we get another awesome fight scene. And they're just sort of flying through the air, more bullet time, and...
shooting and fighting. Fighting and fighting.
But you're empty, so are you. Like, I love that. And then there's a hand-to-hand fight. Neo eventually kills the agent. And sort of the main thing to get from this is that everybody in the Nebuchadnezzar is watching it, and people are like, run. Like, they're thinking, run, Neo.
Yeah.
And the key part is that Neo does not run. Neo's beginning to believe. And yeah, and so he kills an agent, and then three more show up, get off the subway, and it's like, crap, now I'll run.
Okay. And, it's not getting ridiculous here.
Yeah. You know, there's a chase to get into a hotel, or sorry, an apartment building, and Neo eventually gets killed by an agent. He gets shot many times in the chest.
Yep.
Or the stomach, whatever. And yeah, he dies. But what happens next?
Well,
your favorite part of the movie.
I think everyone's favorite part of the movie.
Yeah. I cry every time. It's like Gone with the Wind.
Well, the Sentinels are eating through the Nebuchadnezzar at this point, too. And if Neo's dead, probably going to be the end of the Nebuchadnezzar, end of the rebellion, possibly the end of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn that...
Which are high stakes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the high, all the stakes. And not the kind of steak Cypher eats.
Good point. Yeah. More like the steaks as in De La Soul's fourth album.
Yeah.
Steaks is high, ladies and gentlemen.
And so Trinity is holding Neo's body in the Nebuchadnezzar real world, which is dead. That's what happens.
Yes. When you get shot a bunch of times, you die in the Matrix, you die in real life.
Starts speaking to his body saying, no, this can't be the case. The Oracle told me that I would fall in love with the one. Mm-hmm. I'm in love with you. Therefore, you're the one. Ergo, ipso facto.
You can't die because I love you.
Yeah.
Which is a line that gets said in this film.
Yeah.
Of all the corny things that happen in this movie, of all the really...
What's even close to as corny as that?
All the conveniently timed thunder and lightning.
Okay,
of which there is a lot.
In that castle.
Yeah.
In wherever the hell they
No.
In that urban center.
Early on in the movie too, like constantly, like anytime somebody says anything important, there's a thunderclap. Yeah. It's insanity.
I'll give you that.
Yeah. that's close, but it is not, you can't die because I love you. That is a special kind of ridiculous.
That is not an Avatar line. That's a Matrix
exactly.
line.
That sounds like something James Cameron wrote.
Yeah. So
it might be in Titanic. Have we double-checked
it
this?
It could be in Titanic and Avatar, I think. Mm. Or Titavatar 3D.
Yeah, exactly. Coming soon.
And... it works, though. Yep. It does the trick.
He comes back alive.
Heart starts beating in the real world, and he comes back to life in the Matrix. Much to the chagrin of the agents.
Yep. He dives, or he stops bullets.
Yep.
Says no. And stops the bullets that are flying at him.
Yep.
And then, which is awesome.
Yep.
A talent I wish I had. Not that a lot of people shoot at me, but... in case of, yeah. I would like to be able to do that. Yeah, picks one up, looks at it, and then just drops them all on the ground.
I kind of love his performance right there.
Oh, it's awesome.
The way he looks.
Yeah. But, yeah. Well, that's why Keanu is good in this movie. It's that the idea is that Neo can't believe anything that is happening.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't believe anything that's happening because it's all crazy. And
Keanu is just the most... perplexed.
Exactly.
Looking.
He's constantly perplexed. And that's also why he doesn't work in the second and third one, because he is in control in the second and third one. And his performance is really bad in those because he's still Keanu and he's very one note. And, you know, he can't wipe that look off his face. Like, he always looks confused. And in the first one, Neo is very confused. Second and third one, he is very in charge. You know? So that's the thing there.
Yeah. So he comes back to life. And takes after he stops the bullets, he dives into one of the agents, taking him over.
Making him explode.
Yeah. If you've ever seen someone jump into someone and have them explode and then turn into them, you know that that person has powers.
Yes.
And this is what we're supposed to learn from that part of this movie, is that Neo has some crazy powers within
this world.
He
can dive into people. Like, he can dive into the Agent Smith's stomach.
Yeah. And he kind of sees everything in code now.
Yeah.
And he's completely transcended the Matrix. Like, he sees it for what it is.
He has beaten the game. He has won.
Roll credits.
Yeah. Well, not totally. He gives sort of like a final speech. And
no, roll credits to the game, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
The movie still goes.
Oh, yeah, of course. It's the ending cutscene is what's still coming, basically.
Yeah. So what is that that speech?
Well, it's sort of, you know, we sort of see code kind of like what we saw at the very beginning of the movie. Yeah, you're right. There is a title card at the beginning of the movie, right at the very, very beginning. Yeah.
Okay.
We sort of see something like that as Neo seems to be on a phone call, which is kind of how we see what we see at the very beginning of the movie. We see we hear Trinity on a phone call and see sort of coding going on. And it's sort of that, but now Neo is on a phone call and he doesn't seem to be speaking to anybody in particular, except that he's speaking to everybody.
Yeah.
And, so we see the code and Neo saying, you know, a variety of things like, you're afraid of us, afraid of change. And once he says afraid of change, system failure pops up on front of the code, like change will make the system fail. And then, you know, he says a bunch of other things. He doesn't know the future. He didn't come here to tell you how it ends. He just came to tell you how it begins. And, you know, he says some more things, but the idea is that this is the beginning of something. And then to fully prove that he is just totally superhuman, he flies away. Yeah. And that's the end of the movie. Cuts to black.
What about the audio, though?
Well, yeah, Rage Against the Machine is playing. You know, not,
because
not...
this movie is about Raging Against the Machine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and that's exactly why.
Come on.
So that's a whole lot of awesome.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we weren't the only ones who thought so.
No, very good movie. Critics liked it.
Yep.
Generally.
Especially for an action movie, relative to action movies, it got great critical reviews.
Yeah, and I don't think the studio was surprised by this. I mean, I think The Matrix was a mid-budget movie.
Yeah.
Because it was 60 to 63 million are the figures I found. And this was 1999, so that is a bigger budget than... Like, I think now The Matrix is sort of comparable to, like, a $100 million movie.
Yeah.
Like, The Matrix was got a $100 million budget.
Yep.
Just in the way that... movies work now. But yeah, it wasn't a huge budget movie, and it was sort of, for this type of concept, it wasn't a high risk. And I think it really showed that the studio believed in it, in that it was released on a Wednesday, not before a holiday weekend.
Yeah.
It was March 31st, 1999. And I mean, I suppose that could have been Easter, actually, now that I think about it. But,
that's time for a Jesus movie.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. yeah, and I don't know. It was just well accepted and just an awesome movie. I remember talking to a lot of people about it when I was younger and when it came out. And it was a cultural thing. Like, it had enough iconic... It was a big enough thing, and there were so many iconic moments because of how big it was. And it's a well-respected movie still.
Yeah, and we said all of it kind of got spoofed. A lot of it got spoofed in tons of different movies and TV shows and cartoons and stuff. So, you know you've made a big splash when they assume everybody knows about this and these jokes are going to land, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Made a whole lot of money. I mean, sequels and comic books and games and stuff like that came out of it. So it was a big deal. But yeah, it's something that wasn't just good to watch. I think with a lot of movies that really become part of the cultural landscape for a bit, it's one that people like to talk about.
Yes. Yeah, and it's fun to talk about even beyond the, oh my god, it's awesome!
Which is fun!
Yeah. Which was the basis of me and my friend Nick's friendship for, I think, a year, was that we just both loved The Matrix. And, and all I remember about, like, that time period is us just watching The Matrix at his house. Like, that's all we did.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't regret that decision. But, yeah, and there's, you know, it's sort of like a vaguely philosophical movie. You know, like they say enough things that are kind of philosophical that people that like the movie can put whatever they want into it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's sort of like the idea the thing with any art that wants to be taken seriously, just be vague and then people will do the rest for you.
Again, Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
Good example.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, this isn't... There are some very obvious moments in this movie. I mean, it's the hero's journey. It becomes pretty clear that he's a Jesus. you know, all the rabbit hole, like Alice in Wonderland, you know, it's not a particularly subtle movie a lot of the times, but they keep the key things vague enough that Cornel West will do a commentary on it or whatever, which is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I remember a little bit after this came out, probably that year, maybe, but it seems too young. But for Christmas, I asked for a book called Taking the Red Pill, Science, Religion, and Philosophy in the Matrix.
Yeah, I know that book.
And that was just one of many books that people came out with
on,
like, all those topics. There is tons of ways to look at this movie. one of the biggest IMDb trivia pages I've ever seen.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there's just so much stuff to point out, all the different references, all the different ways to look at things and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you think it still looks good?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God, yes. It's amazing. The bullet time.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about bullet time.
Yeah. Well, I think bullet time would have been used in a lot more movies if The Matrix hadn't been as big as it was. Because The Matrix isn't the first movie to use bullet time, as people have sort of learned. I think Blade 2 uses a version of it. And there was another movie, like, clearly, I can't remember the name. I'll look it up. But there was something else that used it before, like a French movie or something like that.
Yeah, there's like four or five people who have very legitimate claims to being inventing or have developed it or got it to the point where it is, because
it seems like something that would have been used in a commercial beforehand, too.
You know? Yeah, it's just, it is a very complicated technique, and it was just kind of perfected really well by the Wachowski brothers, but
I don't know. It doesn't.
It's basically a series of cameras, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't think it's particularly complex. I think it's just sort of like setting up a really intricate domino thing, and you just have to make sure everything is set up properly. And
do you want to explain how they do it?
Well, yeah. My perception of it is that let's take the first time it's used in The Matrix, where Trinity sort of hops up and the camera rotates around her. The setup around that was a bunch of cameras very, very close together. And I think they were still cameras, like digital SLRs, probably, you know, that type of thing. And then there's sort of like an algorithm programmed into all of these cameras that, when we hit this button, this first camera will take a picture, and then instantly all of the other pictures will take cameras will take a picture in sequence. And when we put them together, they sort of will form this sort of, you know, whoosh.
Yeah.
And it's done in a second, you know, like, and it's just sort of, you get a different look of the scene, and and you just sort of put it all together in editing, and it looks seamless in the movie every time they do it.
I mean, just from watching it, it just seems like it's a camera moving really quickly. Yeah. Not that that makes any technical sense, but that's the way it looks.
Mm-hmm.
I think the difficulty comes in is, even if you have 300 cameras side by side, it's filling in the space in between those two.
Yeah, that's true. Pictures. That is true.
And that would be the difficult part, especially when you have so many things in frame and there are 3D images and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what they really had. Like, that's the one thing they really wanted to perfect.
Okay.
Because I've seen some early ones and it seems a lot more choppy and kind of like staggered than the move from camera to camera.
Yeah.
But yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, and now they do bullet time in like basketball games, and I have no idea how they do that. And
yeah,
blows my mind.
Yeah, and Max Payne was a video game that they used it into.
Yeah,
which was actually a really awesome game.
Yeah, no, it was good. But yeah, like I said, I think had The Matrix not been so iconic, I think more movies would have used it.
Yeah, because now it's like, okay, you're trying to be The Matrix.
Yeah,
we have that. Exactly. Yeah, move on. What do you think? Do you like the visual style of kind of within the world, not just the camera work, but when they're within the Matrix, the way that it looks?
Like the green?
Yeah, that was one thing I want to talk about, even because I noticed the technical stuff about movies way less than you do, let alone when I was 12 years old, 13, whenever I saw it. But this is one of those movies I noticed a theme of colors, like a color motif, right?
They don't hide it.
They lean on the green pretty hard. Like, even the agent suits aren't black. They're dark green.
Well, I think that's sort of
green. Color correction after the fact?
Part of that is, I don't know, because this is before digital color correction. 1999 is too early for, I think the first movie that was really famously digitally color corrected was Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Right.
Which is 2001, I think. And so, I think it must have been some sort of filter, some type of lighting type thing. I don't know much about the actual color correction of film itself. So, I mean, it's possible that they sort of were adding dye.
Okay.
I don't know much about it. But yeah, they go to the balls to the wall with this green. And even like Neo, you know, where Neo is shaven, you know, like you can see his stubble is kind of greenish, you know, like it's everything. And I like it. I think it works. I think it only works because it's such a fantastical movie.
Yeah.
You know, if they were trying to place this in reality, well, I guess they are, but well, I guess not the Matrix parts where things are really green. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the one thing that I think works so well for this movie is I'm not crazy about sci-fi. There's certainly some sci-fi movies that I like a lot,
mm-hmm.
but unlike a lot of fantasy sci-fi stuff, I like stuff that kind of keeps it reasonable and, you know, not too much magic and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, as much as this kind of does have some of that fantasy magic kind of stuff to it, it makes sense. Like, it's within this computer program. Like, there is a physical explanation for why these kind of spectacular, fantastical kind of things can happen.
Yep.
So that's one thing I liked about it.
Yeah. I like a lot of the, there are a lot of really small cutaway shots that are kind of impressive. Like, and are kind of big setups. Like there's one shot when people are running into a building or something. That's like a tracking shot from the building above. And it's not, you know, I don't think the cinematography in this movie is particularly gorgeous, but it's a good looking movie. And I like a lot of the tracking shots, like right into a phone. It's very sort of symmetrical. And yeah, I don't know. I like the visual style of the movie, but I don't think, like, cinematography specifically, I don't think it's anything particularly special.
And so
with the exception of the bullet time, which is cinematography.
Which is awesome. So when they are in the Matrix, where are they?
They're in a computer, are they not?
No, but where, like, what's the explanation for where are they? Like, where are those people in that place think they are?
I don't follow.
Like, where would this movie take place, like, on planet Earth, you know?
Chicago or Australia.
Yeah, you never really, it's kind of like, it's a blur, and then in that, yeah, because it was shot in Australia mostly.
Mm-hmm.
The Wachowskis are from Chicago.
Okay.
And so when they talk about a lot of the intersections and directions and stuff, they use a lot of intersections that exist in Chicago for real. In that rooftop chase, they use a different skyline. They use one of, you see the background of Tennessee at some point. Like, it really is all over the place, even within things that should be in one location.
Gotcha.
And so it kind of just has this sense of, like, a placelessness. Like, it's really universal. And, you know, this movie did really well all over the world. And I think it's cool that they do that, because it is this combination of all these different places. And, you know, they use some kind of, like, regional slang from different countries and stuff like that. And it's just cool that it's kind of an amalgamation of all these different countries and places. And I think it just adds to the universality of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, the Matrix code, it's English letters, but then it's also Japanese characters and some, like, half-mirrored characters and things like that. And I think it just kind of speaks to the way that the whole movie was put together, too, because at the same time, it's, like, a big American blockbuster. Mm-hmm. But it's also, like, a little Hong Kong kung fu movie.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this, you know, again, an amalgamation of all these different styles from all over the planet, and it just comes together to work really, really well.
Yeah, like, all the choreography is done by Yuen Wu-Ping, I think, who either grew up with Jackie Chan or went to the same school as Jackie Chan, sort of like this martial arts school. And there's all kinds of Yuens throughout Hollywood, and sort of like this little magic, this school where all these famous martial arts guys came out of.
Right.
And the choreography is very, I mean, the strings work is very Hong Kong influenced, Hong Kong cinema influenced, and as is the, you know, the martial arts of it all. So there's a lot of, Hong Kong cinema in there, and, you know, it mixes sort of the more American, gunfight type thing into the mix.
Yeah.
Is sort of, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that even with some of the bigger themes we're talking about, people say that it draws on, like, Western philosophy and Eastern philosophy and different religions and things like that. So it's kind of a whole combination of global things, which I think is cool for the themes they go for.
Yeah.
Just another thing I want to talk about the visuals is that there's a lot of mirrors and a lot of reflections in this one. Like the spoon, obviously, we talked about a little bit. That
Morpheus's glasses.
Yeah, a bunch of sunglasses. That big office building with all the windows.
Yep.
And just a lot of, like, using Trinity's rearview mirror to see him go into the agent's custody and stuff like that.
Yep.
And again, just something that I think they connect really well visually with some of the themes of the stuff that happened in the movie, because mirrors are about having a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly having a 180-degree switch on the way you look at things.
Yep.
And, you know, to tie into the way that they think that they own the machines, but the machines are really running them, and, you know, even with the bullet time, too, the camera starts on one side and switches to the other. And it's all about completely inverting your perspective on things and getting a better understanding of what's really happening from it.
Yeah,
so I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I like that.
I guess this is an activity. It's not that much fun, though.
Okay.
No, it's fun. It's just, I don't know.
Does it pick your favorite dead character?
No, it just doesn't have this excitement of the lightning round.
That's fine.
Which I'm used to.
We've only done the lightning round 2 times. It's not like it's...
But it's so exciting.
Okay. No, I love it. We all know how much I love the lightning round.
All right. But you just don't like thunderclaps in the Matrix.
Haven't I told you I'm going to edit this with thunderclaps every 30 seconds? It's going to be our most obnoxious podcast ever.
So this one's called What Should Have Happened.
Okay.
Or This Almost Happened.
Okay.
Keanu Reeves was not the original choice for Neo. We've discussed how you kind of think that the way he acts works really well for
this character. Oh, yeah, he's great for this movie.
Yeah. They approached Nick Cage, mm-hmm. Tom Cruise,
ooh.
Leonardo DiCaprio,
ew.
And Will Smith about this role.
Okay.
If you had to choose one of those four, who would it be? Or do you want to just order them in the way that should have happened? Or how that would have went down if they did use
well,
those people?
Well, Emma, let's say, are we saying using the whole trilogy? Like,
no.
Okay. Just let's say this movie never has a sequel, yeah. basically? Okay.
Let's do that.
So there's, the four options were Keanu, Nicolas Cage, Tom Cruise, and Will Smith.
And Leo.
And Leo. Okay, Leo's number five.
Okay. Why?
I just don't like him.
Okay. Good stuff.
Tom Cruise is number four.
Why? You kind of like him sometimes.
I do. I don't like the idea of him in this.
Yeah, okay.
It just doesn't seem right. And I mean, I've been upfront about the fact that I enjoy Tom Cruise, but we got Will Smith, then Nicolas Cage third.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think it's too kooky. Although this was still when people respected Nicolas Cage, so yeah, I just don't know. I don't know. I would love to see. I think I would like this movie. Maybe I'd like it less if Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, but I kind of think that he brings the same kind of like bewildered characteristic that Keanu does. Mm-hmm. Like he plays a really good, like, you know, when you have Keanu and Nicolas Cage on Celebrity Jeopardy, it's pretty much the same impression.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I think
how I judge all actors.
I think, well, Keanu's calmer.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, it's true.
Nicolas Cage is, you know, just a little too coked up. And then Will Smith, too, and Keanu out of those five, I think, is
okay.
my favorite.
And do you think if Will Smith got it, they would have changed the movie a lot to kind of Will Smithify it?
I don't know. They might have. I think it's sort of like Memento, not Brad Pitt dropping out of Memento. If Brad Pitt was the lead in Memento, it would have a bigger budget and more pressure, and there would have been more influence. If Will Smith in 1999 is the start of The Matrix, that yeah. is a huge budget movie, and
he's still developing his career. Like, he's established, but they're still, I think they would keep a short leash on the whole production, right?
Yeah, well, 1999 yeah. is Wild Wild West. So that is Will Smith at his peak Will Smithiness, and that Wild Wild West was a hit, and everybody knows it's terrible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there would have been a lot shorter leash in that, you know, I just don't see it being as good of a movie
right.
because it would have had a lot bigger budget and, you know.
Yeah. And he turned down this to do Wild Wild West
yes.
and said retrospectively, he thinks it was kind of a mistake. Like he now seeing how good that movie was, he said he'd probably would like to be part of it, but he was worried that he wasn't mature enough for it and he mm-hmm. would have screwed it up.
Which I think is a totally fair assessment and a fairly mature thing for Will Smith to say.
Yeah, no, right? No. all right, Morpheus.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Oldman, Samuel L. Jackson, and Sean Connery approached. Sean Connery said he didn't understand the script and yep. turned it down.
And then later took the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen because he didn't understand that either. And was like, well, it'll be The Matrix. and then retired after League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And then Gary Oldman and Samuel L. Jackson.
Good choices. Two people oh, yeah. I think we both enjoy a lot.
Yeah, well, Gary Oldman's such a wild card, you know, like,
yeah.
Because he can do anything. He could have played it any way. And yeah. Whereas Samuel Jackson and Sean Connery are more known properties, you yeah. kind of know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Like, Gary Oldman, if he goes The Professional, like the way he was in The Professional, I say no. But if he goes like Jim Gordon, then absolutely.
Or True Romance.
Yeah. The Professional and True Romance are both pretty absurd characters. Yeah, I guess I would just by default, Gary Oldman's first because
yeah.
I feel like he can do anything.
Yeah. I have a lot of faith in Gary Oldman.
Then Lawrence Fishburne, then Sean Connery, then Samuel L. Jackson.
Okay. Yeah. And then Jean Reno
yeah.
was approached for Agent Smith.
Wow, that would have been interesting.
And turned it down to do Godzilla.
Yep.
So that's our second swing and a miss on yep. casting choices yep. here. How do you think that would have worked out?
That would have been tricky. I don't know. Hugo Weaving's obviously perfect.
Hugo Weaving is so good in this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He reminds me of Billy Crudup as Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen.
Yeah.
Where it was kind of this character I didn't expect much with. He kind of had to be emotionally disengaged and you kind of want to play it flat, mm-hmm. but he brings something to this character which you just did not see coming at all.
Yeah. No, and I mean, Hugo Weaving can do voices like nobody else. You know, it's just like he's got a type of voice that he can do, and it's the Agent Smith voice. And yeah, he's great. And yeah, I can't imagine Jean Reno being better. I like Jean Reno in general. Like, yeah. I referenced The Professional before you brought it up, so
yep.
I'm clearly a fan. But yeah, I don't know. I can't see him being better, and I'm extremely happy they did not go with him.
Hugo Weaving crushes it. All right. Now I just want to look at this as kind of compared to other kind of movies of its time, and then also other just kind of anti-authoritarian movies, because in a lot of different ways, that's what this is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it seems to be vaguely against government and technology at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, government being the more authoritarian one there. What other anti-authoritarian movies do you like?
Well, I'm a sucker for that type of thing. Like, Cool Hand Luke is one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
What's more anti-authority than Cool Hand Luke? The Bourne movies, which we discussed in the spring. You know, pretty much any time you get somebody raging against the machine, it makes me happy.
Yeah.
I just like that in movies because I like the idea of somebody being able to do it.
Yeah.
I'm... you know, a pacifist in general, but I like seeing that happen. You know, like I like it when the little guy wins, you know?
Yep.
You know, it's corny, but I'm not above it.
yeah.
I just like it. And, I don't know, off the top of my head, there's gotta be plenty.
Well, we talked about
Gattaca.
We talked about American Beauty earlier, which is more of an anti-authority kind of thing. Kind of still the vague.
Well, we talked about it in our Annie Hall podcast, which is next week.
Which is in the future.
How's that for time shifting?
V for Vendetta?
Yeah, I didn't like V for Vendetta.
Yeah, I don't think you did. Equilibrium?
Yeah, that's true. Equilibrium's a cool movie.
And then kind of the opposite of The Matrix, but Office Space.
Yeah, true. Yeah, the idea behind The Matrix, though, is it did that, like all the other movies you're listing are... you know, movies that people know with the, you know, nobody knows Equilibrium, and V for Vendetta has generally been forgotten.
Yeah.
But The Matrix did this on a huge scale.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the Bourne movies aren't The Matrix. They were huge to the point where the franchise is continuing still. But yeah, it's, you can't even compare it to The Matrix.
Yeah.
Because The Matrix is, you know, you might see a bullet time spoof in Scary Movie 5 somewhere, you know, like it'll just happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of part of the reason why I like The Matrix. And in general, like, I like the idea of control. Like, the movie's about control and fate. And there's a line where Neo says, I think it's to Morpheus, that he doesn't like the idea of that he's not in control of his own life. And I think that's sort of the main point of the movie, is sort of either take control or who controls, you know? And and I like that a lot about The Matrix. And yeah, just the idea of fate, like, is the idea, because I mean, fate is one of those things that you can think about forever and never ever figure out.
Yeah,
because you won't figure it out. And I like a movie that will question fate, and The Matrix is sort of like, I like the idea of being in control. It's because, you know, Neo is picking an unhappy reality over a happy unreality, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, there's very much the questions of control. Like we said, it's anti-authoritarian. I mean, we're battling against the machines, you know, like,
yeah.
So, you know, and it's even that line, I like, it's sort of, I mentioned it earlier, and it's sort of the idea of change, where Trinity says no one's ever done anything like this. Neo saying that's why it's going to work.
Yeah.
And that's something I enjoy in life. I mean, that's why I liked Moneyball as much as I did, is because, you know, I mean, they play fast and loose with the facts in that movie, but that movie's very much about trying something new and having that new thing work in a system where you don't get to try a lot of new things, and it's very high risk. That's even why I've sort of come around to the whole Tim Tebow thing. It's that they're doing something that is totally unconventional and it's working.
Yeah.
And they're doing it in a very conventional sort of thing. Like, you know, people have written about how football is, it's slow to adapt. Like, anybody that tries something new is kind of crazy. And, you know, that's how people are looking at the Tim Tebow offense. And,
yeah.
But it's working, and that's cool. And, you know, like, he's still not a good passer, but he might be a good quarterback, you know, like, and that's crazy, but it's awesome that it works. And I just love stuff like that in real life, with the Billy Beane thing, or, you know, I recognize both my ideas are sports, but you know, just in general, anytime you can do something new and make it work, that's cool.
Yeah. I want to go back to one thing you said about the ending of the movie, which is when he chooses kind of the flawed reality versus a perfect unreality. I was thinking about its connections with Inception. And I mean, there's some questions about how, if that is the ending of Inception, that he chooses that, or if that is real. But it seems like they're both, you know, big summer movies. You know, these were huge summer blockbusters with kind of existential themes. And just kind of how you think they connect. And one of the first things you wrote about for the website was, you know, I'm not going to repeat it. You can kind of sum it up if you want at the start of your answer. But just about, you know, how people saw this as a smart movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like an action movie, but it's like a smart action movie. And, you know, you're one of the smart ones if you like this movie. Do a lot of those ideas apply to The Matrix too? Or do you think it was just more of a straight up action movie that succeeded for being an action movie? And then some people took it on that level, but they liked that movie because it had good action, not because they felt smart or appeared smart for liking it.
Well, you get a lot of the same thing. First of all, Inception and The Matrix are extremely similar movies.
Yeah.
And not even just in that they were both, you know, quote unquote, smart blockbusters, but that, like, there's an architect in The Matrix, there's an architect in Inception.
Yeah, and there's a real world, and then there's this other level, and
yeah,
you jump in and out of them. And
yeah. The idea of happy reality, unhappy reality, happy unreality, that type of thing. And, yeah, I don't know. 'Cause I mean, I was too young when The Matrix was popular to sort of, or, you know, came out to really, remember, but, I think there's a big difference in that there was 11 years in between these two movies, and, people are perceived in so many different ways now, than they were in 11 years. And I hate bringing up like social media and all that stuff, but there are so many more images of ourselves on, online and in real life that we're sort of more worried about how we're perceived, because there are so many more ways to be perceived or misperceived. And people always want to appear smart. And that was kind of the point of my Inception thing, is that a lot of people will, I think, I don't know, I haven't read it in like a year, but you know, since I wrote it, but I don't know, like, I don't think The Matrix was sort of accepted widely as a piece of smart media. I think it was accepted as a movie that people liked. And you could put as much thought into it as you wanted. But I think Inception sort of asked for more thought, in that the ending was, I mean, I don't think it was a very open ending, but the ending seemed open to everybody.
Yeah.
And I think the ending is very important to Inception's, the way people talked about Inception, because, you know, it leaves the audience hanging. And, you know, does the top fall? Does it not? Does it matter? And that there's three options in the very last shot is sort of why Inception was taken extremely seriously.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting between the two, because it seems like retrospectively, like, Inception should have been in 99 and Matrix should have been the more recent one. And I think it's just because, again, there's so many similarities, but Matrix is so much more about technology. You know, there are different realities in Inception too, but they're not as technology based. They're more dream based, and that goes back, you know, since humans started existing, probably, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Inception is more human movie in that it's not humans versus machines; it's just humans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I just think it's interesting now, because I think Matrix would make more sense. No, not that it didn't make sense, but I think it would have been even more timely now with, again, what you're saying about social media. And people bring it up a lot when talking about movies now, but I think it applies to The Matrix really well. And, you know, now it's about having a digital form of everything, as you're saying, like more pictures, more recordings, more videos, whatever. And that's the way that the way culture is now, more so than it used to be. And basically, you know, The Matrix is about things existing because of technology, in reality being technology and media.
Mm-hmm.
Like, technology is kind of the organ with which we measure our existence now. And in The Matrix, it is the one that allows us to exist that mm-hmm. way. And like, that's what reality is. So I just feel like it's an excellent movie then. And just now it would, I think, be probably appreciated even more, because a lot of people would be able to have that element to plug into it, along with all the other things that you can already talk about this movie with, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Anything else to say about The Matrix?
Well, I mean, I guess
I don't know. I think, like, going back to the sort of anti-authoritarian and the fate thing, it's just, I like it, and I recognize how corny it is that, you know, Neo's last scene is essentially a call to action, and he's sort of like, he's basically saying, if we don't follow the system's rules, we'll have a world with no rules. And then he flies away to prove, look how few rules I have to deal with right now. Fuck you, gravity. You know, like, and, you know, it's sort of, it goes back to the whole, the Oracle scene that I love so much is that she, with the exception of Morpheus, which she's right about, and the noodle baking line, right? If she never mentions something, does anything happen? And it's sort of like the idea that she is sort of perceived as this, you know, all-seeing thing, but are people reacting to her, or is she, does she actually know something and things are happening, you know,
yeah,
just because she knew about it. And that's why I like that scene so much. It's because the Oracle seems like this sort of permanent thing, you know, this thing that is right all the time, and this is the way we have to be. But she's sort of incorrect in the end, I think, in that neither Neo nor Morpheus dies in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, by the end of the trilogy, but you know, did they have a trilogy before this movie ends?
It was supposed to be.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
Fair enough.
But she says what they needed to hear, and that's what they say about her, is that her predictions aren't right, but they affect change in the way that everybody wants it.
Mm-hmm. But that's also vague. Like, yeah, the whole idea is that it's just sort of this vague thing that, you know, says these things and, okay, we have to do them, or we are going to do them. It's predetermined.
Yeah.
But there's ways around it, you know, and it's just sort of, you can choose a way around it and you can fly away at the end. You know, like, you can have a world without rules. And I like that idea because it's never going to happen in real life. But I just like that in my blockbusters. You know?
Right on.
And that's why I like the Oracle scene so much, because, you know. And I suppose she's shown to be a machine by the end of the trilogy, you know? Yeah. So I guess that kind of proves my point. But
cool.
Yeah. So yeah, thank you for listening to our podcast, and we'll be back next week with that podcast about Annie Hall that Jim mentioned earlier. Oops.
You should email us though.
Yeah. Like me or people?
People.
The MacGuffinMen@gmail.com. Yeah, the next couple of weeks we've got Annie Hall, and then we've got a two-part podcast on David Fincher, and then our 50th episode. It's going to be a celebration, so be sure to check that out. All right. TheMacGuffinMen.com and TheMacGuffinMen@gmail.com. Email us. Tweet us. Peace.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Scarface, making it easy for rappers to pick their favorite movie since 1983. Be sure to check out TheMacGuffinMen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.